Our Father, as we come here this evening, we come in the recognition of our need of the Spirit to help us to understand the Word and to be able to apply it in a practical, meaningful way. And we ask it in Christ's name, amen. All right, we're still plowing through Colossians. Verse 21, "And you then were alienated and enemies in your understanding through the works of evil," or evil works. Talking, of course, to Colossians, who had been part of the Gentile people as such, you know, the Greeks, who were settled in Asia Minor, with the Jewish people among them. The Jews, as you may recall my saying, were scattered throughout Asia Minor, and it's called what we call a diaspora, which means the distribution in Greek, the diaspora. An edict went out from Rome that the Jews were no longer allowed to live in Rome. So they scattered throughout Asia Minor and throughout the Balkan Peninsula and Greece, Asia. And that's why you have these colonies, say in Colossae and Galatia and other places where there were Jews. There were quite a few Jews in those places. And Peter writes his letters precisely to the diaspora. In the English text, I think it says to the dispersion. But the word diaspora is a technical word that refers to that incident where the Jews were required to leave Rome and settle elsewhere. Now here's this pocket of people in Colossae that Paul is writing to. And he says, "You were alienated and enemies in your understanding in evil works." I think I've said to you before, but I want to sort of bring this together again. Dianoia means the mental processes. Nous means mind, and dianoia or dianous would be have to do with the things working through the mind, the mental process. In the brain, you have things that are simply reflex actions. You have centers in the brain, in the cortex. For example, you have the temporal lobe, which is sort of the center of hearing and smelling as well, and that's at the side. And then you have the occipital lobe at the back, which is for seeing. And then you have the parietal lobe, which is just above the occipital, between the occipital lobe and the top of the head, which is the area of motor and sensory experience. So right at the top of the brain cortex is the area, there's a band there, which is the area of sensory and motor nerves, which means that's where the action takes place that causes you to do things. In the front of the brain is the frontal lobe, and that's where all the integration of thoughts takes place. So, for example, if we'll use a classic illustration, if you burn your finger on a hot iron, there's a reflex action that causes you immediately to pull the finger back, but that is an impulse that goes only to the spinal column and back to the finger. Very short trip, and it immediately pulls the finger away. However, that triggers an impulse that goes up to the frontal lobe of the brain, which makes the decisions about the nature of the situation. So, for example, the reflex causes you to pull your finger back, but the frontal lobe will integrate the ideas and determine whether or not you ought to medicate it, put unguentine on it, or just what, wrap it in a bandage or let it go or whatever, see? So that's, but the action that the frontal lobe decides upon is then executed by the motor area, which is at the top of the brain cortex. Now, from an evolutionary point of view, the gibbon or the ape, which some people claim we were descended from, does not have this frontal lobe, which is the area of integrated thought. And so if you notice the skull of an ape, it starts from the supraorbital ridge, which is the brow, and there's no forehead. It goes right back to the crown of the head, see, where the sensory nerves are. So the whole frontal area is gone, which is the area that would allow the ape to do intelligent things rather than merely intuitive things. So, for example, the ape lives in the tree, and the man cuts the tree down and makes a house out of it. The ape eats bananas, and the man makes a pie out of them. That's the difference. You could conceivably take a very intelligent chimp, which is what they work with in the movies, who seem to be so human. You take a chimp and teach it by color coding to punch keys on a typewriter, and it could probably punch out its name on the typewriter through color coding, but it could never write a book. The Adventures of Abner the Ape, not going to do that. The important thing here is that the dianoia, the through the brain thing, the mind thing, is not simply the brain per se as an instrument, because it includes the idea of integrated thought, which is where what we've talked about with the grid pattern on the brain, where you've got the construct of a grid pattern on the brain includes all the mental activities that are germane to one's life, whether through heredity or environment. All the experiences, all the knowledge, everything is recorded on the cortex. Now, how that information is integrated into life activity depends upon the nature of the experiences and the heredity and so forth. So people are sort of almost coded to function in a given direction. But it's the frontal lobe that takes all of those natural human factors and puts them into a meaningful kind of understanding. You can see why I'm not too impressed with the ability of the brain to think straight, the natural human mind, because it is so much affected by all the events and experiences, hereditary factors of one's life. That's why I've said to you that you, if people have an image of Christ or of Jesus on the cortex, but they have constructed out of their own human thought patterns. And thus, if they need a father image, Jesus becomes the father image to them. If they need someone sweet and lovely who prances through the meadow with them, that's what comes up on their brain. But, you see, we inscribe that pattern of who Jesus is on our brain, depending on how we think. Now, the real truth of who Christ is in our spirits. And we function out of the spirit more realistically than out of the brain. And our reaction to Christ is a reaction of the spirit. And that's why we stay steady in spite of all the things that are hard to understand, because even though they may tend to, the events of our lives may tend to cause problems with our mental image of Jesus, even though that is true, the spirit within us still holds us steadfast in the realities of Christ. So there's a communion between our spirits and the spirit of Christ that does not always move into the brain areas. Still, we have to use the brain to work with. You know, we have no other choice. We come to a meeting here by the use of our mental powers to get here and to function. But the truth that comes to us from in this place will not be the combined concepts and thoughts of our brains here assembled. One of the things I have against the open meeting where everybody throws their 2 cents in is, what are they coming out of? Where are they getting their information? But people do that all the time. You know, I've always said the person in the room that has the most to say about something is probably the most ignorant about it. But that's just the nature of people, and eventually, I guess, if we not kick things around enough, we may come to some understanding. But now, the reading, you may say, well, what has that got to do with Colossians? Well, much, every way. Because he says that these people were alienated and enemies in their understanding in evil works. What is the point here? Very simple. The dianoia, the mental process of the non-believer, is totally unreliable. His whole thought process is skewed. And he can't think straight if he had a ruler in his pocket. Just doesn't think straight. Now, God called the shots in the Old Testament, what people still don't understand. A lot of people are very unhappy the way God treated the poor Canaanites and so forth. I will tell you this. The Canaanites were such a corrupt society. And when the Rosh Shamra tablets were discovered, which had the Ugaritic writings on them that described the Canaanite civilization, they were translated by the Eastern linguists. They would not allow them to be distributed in the libraries because of the rottenness of the material in it, the corruptness of the evil of the discussion there. If they were, as I suspect, agents of Satan, the leadership certainly was, and it may be that they represented part of Satan's host. See, in Genesis it says that sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and went into them. And the expression sons of God would have not to do with good angels necessarily, but with the bad angels, and it corrupted the society. And so you had a mingling of the demonic forces of Satan with persons on the earth, and that may be what brought about the Canaanite society, civilization. That's why God could say, just wipe it out. You know, even today over in Iraq, you can see the deceptiveness of things where the people of Iraq are willing to accept a large number of them. Hussein is a hero and they won the war, but they have very little sense of what went on in Kuwait and the brutality and so forth. But they just, of course, the Muslim religion has conspired to get everything in deceptiveness and confusion. The whole history of the Middle East has been a history of brutality and devastation from the beginning. And I've said to you before that the Muslim religion is probably the most brutal, merciless religion on earth. Now you take a Buddhist or a Hindu or Shinto or whatever, they may be off base, but they sort of live and let live. The whole Oriental mystic philosophy is in that vein. We believe what we believe, you believe what you want to. But as far as the brutality is concerned, they don't hold a candle to the Muslims who have been, and I think I've told you before, the Saracens, who were Muslims, swept across North Africa in the 9th century, and butchered everybody that wouldn't conform to the Muslim faith. People have said, well, the Christian church has had its sad chapters, and that is very true. We've had sad chapters, the Crusades and other things. However, the difference is this. Basically, we do not consider that at all a part of Christianity or a part of fundamental Christianity. The Muslim, on the other hand, believes that that's the will of Allah. And that butchering infidels gives them a special place in the Garden of Allah, in paradise. And that jihads, the holy wars, where they go out and engage in wars against the infidels, all these things give them a special place with Allah. Well, that's germane to their religion. It's not just some aberration, which we have had plenty of in Christendom. But we don't accept that as basic. So remember this, I've mentioned it before, remember this, that the word Allah is merely a deity of the Muslim religion and has nothing to do with the God of the Bible. They're two different altogether, any more than the Buddha has anything to do with Christ, you see, although some people think that they are equal, but Buddha has nothing to do with Christ. Allah has nothing to do with the God of the Bible. It's a separate deity, like any pagan deity that the Muslim people have made their God. And they borrowed sections from the Old Testament and some new to include in their Quran, but of course God parts company from them the moment they deny that Isaac is the heir. Because God said, in Isaac shall thy seed be called, to Abraham. And they have Ishmael because it gives them a large piece of real estate. Remember, as I have said to you before, what the Arab says to his brethren in Arabic and what he says in English are two different things. So just keep that in your mind, that the God of the Bible has no relevance whatever to the Allah of the Muslim religion. If somebody tries to tell you that, tell them they just pull prunes or dates or something. But the society in the Middle East has been a brutish society. And remember, that is where the action is going to take place in the ultimate end of things. The Middle Eastern cataclysms that will take place after, especially after Armageddon, but maybe before that, after the Christians are out. But that's where the theater of activity will be, in the Middle East. And those who feel that the whole world is going to be under one ruler, for example, there are a lot of people that believe that. And they see this great Antichrist, which is a false consideration anyway, because I've said before, the Antichrist is merely a false Messiah and not an against Christ person. And the Americans are not going to be hep to taking a false Messiah in. Might have some Jewish people in America that will, but we're not all looking for the Messiah here. So the Jews will be looking for their Messiah, and how long it'll be now before their situation gets in such straits that they're going to welcome some champion who will come along and promise to deliver them from these things. But as it seems now, it looks to me as though they might now start into an era of prosperity, because when Hussein started bombing Jerusalem, they won a lot of sympathy from other Arab populations like the Sauds and others. And then when Palestine joined with Hussein, the rest of the Arabs, like the Sauds, are not going to be too worried about whether Palestine gets its due or not. There's no way to really tell how it's going, but it could be a period when Israel will be allowed to expand and to develop. I don't say it absolutely is. I'm just saying it's a possibility. I don't know anything about the era between now and the coming of the Messiah, the false Messiah, which I believe, as I've said, comes out of the Muslim world. Wouldn't be too hard to say that, because everything that isn't Israel is Muslim up there anyway. But he left the God of his fathers, according to Daniel, and worshiped the God of forces. Yet he could come back into Jerusalem as a true Jew, obscuring his Muslim connection, you see. And then a little ways into the situation, when he's gotten the power he wants, he could then display his true colors, and then all of Jerusalem would be under his control. And remember, it says there that you couldn't buy or sell without the mark of the beast, which is the Antichrist, or the false Messiah. When he finally becomes the tyrant that he was all along, then you can't buy or sell without a mark in your forehead. But anyway, that's the point then, when things get really bad, that now comes Christ to deliver the Jews from the Antichrist. And that's when great catastrophes take place to bring about that deliverance. Well, Then when Jesus, or when Christ has delivered Jerusalem, he sets up the millennial reign, and for 1,000 years there is peace over there. Now, according to Ezekiel 38, when Satan is loosed, both Revelation 20 and Ezekiel 38, Satan has been bound for 1,000 years during this millennial period, and when he's released from that, then he goes and gathers together all of his cronies who have not repented but have been laying low, and a great holocaust takes place in the Middle East, which will be the true Armageddon. Then after that is wiped out by Christ in very short order. The natural phenomena, or God's hand, wipes out that ray that comes up against Jerusalem and Israel, and then is established the everlasting kingdom. But that up to that point where the false Messiah comes in on the scene, I don't know what is going to take place in terms of activity for or against Israel.